here's my yearly shout out to all our Latino listeners. This past Thursday was December 12th, the feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe. In 1531, a lady from heaven appeared to a peasant by the name of Juan Diego, just outside of Mexico City. She said to him, "Know for certain that I am the perfect and perpetual Virgin Mary, Mother of the True God," and instructed him to have the bishop build a temple on the site. Juan Diego was not too sure about this, and Mary said to him, "Don't be afraid. Am I not here? Am I not your mother?" As proof of her apparition, she left an image of herself imprinted miraculously on his tilma. This poor quality cactus cloth should not have lasted 20 years, but shows no sign of decay almost 500 years later and still defies all scientific explanations of its origin. This single event was the defining one for Catholicism in Mexico and in Latin America. In less than 20 years, some 9 million Mexicans were converted to Christianity. Guadalupe is also the most popular Marian shrine in the world, with an estimated 10 million pilgrims visiting the Basilica each year, and it is also the most visited Catholic church in the world next to the Vatican. So, on this week, let's celebrate the Church of Latin America, because Latinos have a mother, and she is the Mother of God, the Lady from Heaven, who came to a peasant, looking very much like a peasant herself, speaking to him in his native language and giving him and his people hope. Viva la Guadalupana! I'm Deacon Pedro, and this is the Salt and Light Hour. Hello and welcome to an all-new Salt and Light Hour. I'm Deacon Pedro, and sitting here with me today is Germaine Bagnell.
Germaine. Hello, hello. Hello. How is the beginning of the Advent season?
I was going to ask you the same question. The beginning of Advent season. Good. I realized that one of the things I like about Advent is that all of a sudden, like all of the readings, and if you're doing like the liturgy of the hours, morning and evening prayer, it's like everything is just like zooms in. It's like, come Lord Jesus. He's like, come Messiah. Come. It's like the come. So I'm liking that. So far, I'm liking that.
Oh, that's great. That
and
is
you?
Great.
How's it going for you?
Enjoying it. My wife and I have moved, so we're at a new church, and you know, just kind of enjoying this new community that we're building, and just kind of really, really taking the Advent season in stride.
Okay, well, that's good. So Advent, new beginnings. Sometimes we think Easter is new beginnings, but Advent, I suppose, could be new beginnings too. That's a good way, good way to look at Advent. Germaine, today we're going to be joined by Marie-Claude Lalonde of Aid to the Church in Need. She's going to be telling us about every year they have a Christmas campaign.
Yes, the Red Mass?
The Red Mass is for persecuted Christians, and that happened in November. But they have a campaign specifically focusing on a particular country or a particular crisis. And this year, she wants to tell us about a situation in Burkina Faso, because that's where their Christmas campaign is focusing, on that country. I'm not going to go as far as saying that I've never heard of Burkina Faso. I'm not entirely sure I know exactly where it is. So it'll be good to learn a little bit about that country and to find out what's happening there and how we can help the Christians in that country. So that's in about 5 minutes, Where God Helps with Marie-Claude Lalonde from Aid to the Church in Need. And then Germaine, you have two books for us.
I do. As per usual, one for the children and one for adults. And the one for adults is a twist on a very well-known epic poem. And I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Epic poems. All right. Okay. So everybody's brains, the wheels are spinning. What's an epic poem? Okay. So looking forward to that. Book ends with Germaine in about 15 minutes. And then, so Germaine, I'm sure you probably have heard of Henry Nouwen, a Dutch writer, a theologian, spiritual thinker. And the reason why in Canada, a lot of us know him because he lived, even though he was Dutch, he lived in Canada because he lived with the L'Arche community, The LARCH,
Oh.
which is a community for people with adults with intellectual disabilities. And
Oh, yes. Okay, now it's coming together. I'm like, why do I know
yes,
this
you know the
name?
name. Yeah. So he lived at LARCH Daybreak in Richmond Hill, Ontario.
My old stomping grounds as a kid.
That's it. Like right, and the house where he lived, you can stay on, like you can do a weekend retreat there. At Daybreak in LARCH. So Henry Nouwen, he died in 1996, but he's known as one of the most influential spiritual writers of our time. And while he was living, part of the time when he was living at Daybreak at LARCH, he met a woman, Carolyn Whitney Brown, or rather, I should say, Carolyn was living at Daybreak with her family, and she met Henry. And so Carolyn has written a book that she says that she co-authored with Henry Nouwen, and it's called
Okay.
Flying, Falling, Catching. And it's this crazy, I mean, this is fascinating read about a time that, or a connection that he had with a troupe of trapeze artists. So that's all I'm going to say because, yes,
Okay.
I can see your reaction there. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is clearly something that's going on the list. You could potentially see this next month for
Next month for
bookends.
bookends. So Flying, Falling, Catching is the story of Henry Nouwen's friendship with the Flying Rodley's trapeze troupe. And so Carolyn Whitney Brown has co-authored this book, some of his writings, and then of course she adds a little bit from her perspective. So we're going to be speaking with Carolyn Whitney Brown in our second half hour in about 25 minutes. So I'm really looking forward to that conversation.
My ears are going to be glued for that one.
Absolutely. And then at the end of the program, we're going to meet a liturgical composer, Kevin Kyle. He's been writing sacred music for 40 years, and now he has a new instrumental Advent Christmas collection called Winter Birth. Not quite at Christmas, but we're still in Advent, so it's okay to play a little bit of Christmas music. It's instrumental, so I think it'll help our listeners get into that Christmas spirit as we approach that blessed day. So that'll be in about, I don't know, 45 minutes or so. We'll be talking to Kevin Kyle, and we'll be listening to some of his songs from this collection throughout the show. And so a reminder, if people are not going to be around, you can always go to our website, esomedia.org. You can click on podcasts. You can listen to all our programs there. You can also now download the Salt and Light Plus app anywhere you get your apps, and that will give you access not just to this program, but to all our TV shows and our live stream and our documentaries. So that's Salt and Light Plus on your app store. And then of course you can also subscribe to this podcast anywhere you get your podcast. So there you go. That's all the housekeeping for today, Jermaine.
So much good stuff.
So let's start with a song to get us to continue this Advent feeling. Here is O Come Emmanuel from Kevin Kyle's new album, Winter Birth. Thank you. That was O Come, O Come, Emmanuel from Kevin Kyle's new album, Winter Birth. And we're going to be speaking with Kevin Kyle in about 35 minutes. So stay tuned. And now it's time for Where God Helps with Marie-Claude Lalonde from Aid to the Church in Need Canada. Marie-Claude, welcome back to the program. It's good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you too.
So you have news from Burkina Faso that I'm sure most of our listeners have not heard about.
Yes, actually, Burkina Faso is going through a very rough period. There's a lot of violence over there. And as you said, nobody talks about it. It's a forgotten situation. Just to give you an idea, in August and October, there were over 500 dead in Burkina Faso because of violence. And it's very sad because it's a beautiful story in Burkina Faso. Muslims and Christians used to get along so well, but now you have these extremists and they're the one causing the violence. So everyday people are not part of the problem. It's just some groups, you know, who are violent with the population.
And these are groups that are rebelling against the government? Like, is it a political or is it a religious? Are these, not to say that they are Muslim terrorists, but is it fueled by faith or religion?
It's always difficult to know, but yeah. In Burkina Faso, they have an interesting soil with natural resources that could also be the reason behind it. But what we see is extremism and not the real reason. What I mean is the facade is religious,
right?
And the rest, we're not so sure.
Yeah, exactly. Quite often it's politically and financially motivated. So Western Africa, because that's very similar to my other countries in Africa have similar situations with, because of the natural resources. You said that the Muslims and the Christians used to get along well and live amicably up until about 10 years ago.
Exactly.
What is the percentage of Muslims versus Christians?
You have 55% Muslims and 25% Christians.
Okay.
And relations were very good. Burkina Faso was the example we were giving.
Oh, really?
To say to people, you know, everybody can get along. And that was the example, but now it's no longer the case.
Yeah, because 25% is not a small, it's a minority, but it's not small. Of that percentage, do you know how many would be Roman Catholic or Catholic?
No, I have no idea. Just have global figures on Christians.
Right.
But we are in touch with the Catholic dioceses over there to try to help with that emergency campaign. And what we want to provide is actually food, medication, hygiene products, schooling for children, because when children are displaced, most of the time they can't go to school, and some formation on trauma healing. Because the situation is so difficult that people are traumatized and they need some help. So we're helping with formation.
Okay.
So they can have people to accompany them during these difficult times.
And the relief or the assistance that you're able to provide, is it done through the diocese or through the Catholic churches?
It is through the dioceses, through the Catholic Church, as usual. And it's the bishops who are telling us what they need in their precise diocese.
Okay. And is it the same as in other African nations where the Catholic Church has some influence?
Politically, they don't have a lot of influence.
No.
And you have to know that the government is very weak. So they don't have a lot of influence. But on the ground, if we're not talking about the political level, on the ground, the church continues to advocate for harmonious relationships between the people of all religions.
Exactly.
Not only Christians and Muslims.
Of course.
All religions. And the church said that they would continue on to promote that as long as they can.
Of course, the church is providing relief to everyone, not just Christians. So this is a campaign that you're doing. It's an emergency campaign for Christmas.
Yes.
Are there any details other than people knowing that they can go to your website to support this campaign specifically? Is there anything else that people need to know?
Well, I don't think so, but we encourage people to go on our website because of the strike with Canada Post. It's even more important to go on the website and to make your donation online.
That's a good point, because I would suspect that a lot of your supporters like to put their check in the
The check
mail.
in the mail, yes.
For those of you listening in the United States, there is a postal strike here in Canada. So absolutely, but it's very easy to donate online. Just go to the website in Canada, acn-canada.org. But this is not just a, is it a, it's not a, just a Canadian campaign. It's Aid to the Church in Need
It's
worldwide.
worldwide, yes.
So it doesn't matter where, what country's website people go to, they can donate through church Aid to the Church in Need for this specific Christmas campaign to support the situation in Burkina Faso. Thank you, Marie-Claude, for telling us about this, for letting us know about what's happening in this part of the world that we never hear about. And once again, for all the work that you do, and we assure you of donations and prayers.
Thank you so much.
Okay, and have a blessed Advent season and a blessed Christmas.
Same to you.
Marie-Claude Lalonde is the National Director of Aid to the Church in Need Canada. You can find out more about ACN in Canada, acn-canada.org, and in the United States, churchinneed.org.
Hi, I'm Jackie Minton, Catholic singer-songwriter, and you are listening to the Salt and Light Hour with Deacon Pedro.
You can watch Salt and Light Television on our streaming platform, Salt and Light Plus. Find out how to subscribe at slmedia.org and download the Salt and Light Plus from your favorite app store. And now it's time for Book Ends with Germaine Bagnell, who's still here. Okay, Epic Poem. You're probably going to leave that first for last, right?
Yes. I'm going to bury the lead on that one,
okay.
And we'll jump into something that is very timely.
Yes.
This book is called The Beautiful Lady, Our Lady of Guadalupe by Pat Mora, illustrated by husband and wife duo Steve Johnson and Lou Fancher. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially the story of Our Lady of Guadalupe, but told through a grandmother retelling the story to her grandchildren within the book. And it's a beautifully illustrated children's book. I'm not an artist. So when I say the medium, I think it is, if I'm wrong, please forgive me. It looks sort of like those old pastel oil sort of crayons with mixed media within the art.
Yeah.
And so it gives it like this beautiful, just warm, cozy sort of feeling when you look at the art. But it's great. Like for somebody like myself who is a revert, there's a world of things I don't know. So I didn't know much about the story of Our Lady of Guadalupe. So with the grandmother retelling the story to her grandchildren and talking about Juan Diego's encounter with Our Lady, it was really informative for me.
Yeah.
And it's done in, you know, it's a grandmother telling the story to her grandkids. So it's done in a really simple manner, just kind of lays out his journey, encountering Our Lady, being told to go to the bishop to say where he needs to build a church, and just that journey of back and forth until bringing a sign, which we now have in that art from his tunic, that he wore.
Yeah.
So it's really simple retelling. You know, it's not like they're reimagining it or anything like that, because you don't need to. It's just the straightforward tale, a great way to teach children about Marian apparitions for reverts like myself, who just simply didn't know about it. So it's simple, it's beautiful, it's cute, and it's really helpful, because isn't Our Lady's feast day just around the corner?
December 12th. Yes, absolutely.
December 12th. Yeah. So this is a great way to read and maybe
it
learn
is.
How
it
to
is.
Celebrate it.
It is. Now, would you say that this is for the younger children, or is it okay for older children?
I would say it's for younger children, but I could also see how it could become a family tradition as a child gets older.
Nice. That's just a good idea.
Yeah, just kind of a reminder of what Our Lady represents and how it can be celebrated, like the importance of the rose. And,
right.
You know, and within the book, they're baking cookies and making these little flowers. So it just shows, hey, right. maybe this is a way that it can,
what a great idea.
Faith
yeah.
can kind of be incorporated.
Yeah, I like that. And I like that I'm sure that there's something in the story about that relationship between the grandmother and the grandchildren. So that's a great way to tell the story. The Beautiful Lady, Our Lady of Guadalupe by Pat Mora, illustrated by Steve Johnson and Lou Fancher. Okay. Epic novel. You're keeping
Epic
me here in suspense.
Novel. Okay, so we are all familiar with The Divine Comedy by Dante Alighieri.
Yeah.
So I am currently reading that, but, you know, we've all heard about it. There's tons of things that are written about it. So what can I cover in a couple of minutes of The Divine Comedy?
Yeah, you got 2 minutes. That's it.
There we go. So hard pivot towards a recently released graphic novel adaptation of Dante's Inferno.
Oh.
Done by French brothers Paul and Gaetan Brizzi. The art is exquisite. It's basically like graphite or pencil or charcoal or something like that. It really does a spectacular job of showing Dante's journey through hell with Virgil. The art is just fantastic. And one of the things I really love about the art, they show the different circles of hell and its consequences, but also they show, I don't want to use hell and grandeur in the same sort of phrasing.
Ooh, oh, yeah. Okay. Fair.
But in the sense of it shows the scale of hell, scale of these monumental sins in the environment of hell.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And something like, I enjoy graphic novels. So something I can really appreciate of what the Brizzi brothers did is how the panels sort of connect to one another. So as Virgil and Dante are sneaking by the Minotaur going towards this broken gate, a few panels later, if you look sort of in the little bit in the distance in the background of the art, you see the gate that they have traversed.
Right.
It leads them down into something new. So the art is just absolutely stunning. And these gentlemen, these brothers, super, super talented. They have done other graphic novels, but also they've done art direction for a lot of like Disney movies and independent movies. So they are just amazingly talented. And I think it's a really good way for those who want to engage with the Divine Comedy, but aren't prepared to read the entire thing, you know,
what
epic poem from the 14th century can be a bit of a hard read
and
in the
maybe,
21st century.
Yeah. And I'm thinking maybe even for a younger audience, you know, maybe even a high school student that's might be, you know, it's a more accessible than reading this poetic. Yeah. Okay. Dante's Inferno, the graphic novel. I'm going to definitely check that out because I'm not really into graphic novels very much, but there's been the few that you read, and it really is a whole other experience in terms of living through or journeying through a story. So Dante's Inferno by Dante Alighieri, but illustrated by Paul and Gaetan Brizzi. And it's published by Abrams, The Art of Books.
Yes, and it was published November 2024.
So, so it's fresh off the press. And it would have been published in French originally?
Originally in French, but has been adapted to English.
Okay, cool. Okay, that's great. So Dante's Inferno and the graphic novel. Yeah, that's great. And then Beautiful Lady, Our Lady of Guadalupe. We didn't say that was published by Random House Children's Books. So great. Okay, so some ideas for Christmas maybe as people are putting something in your children's stockings. The graphic novel for the older teenagers
and
Our Lady of Guadalupe for the little ones. Okay, Jermaine, thank you so much for these two suggestions and always good to see you. Have a blessed end of the Advent season and a Merry Christmas.
Likewise.
Jermaine Bagnall is our book contributor. He's also the producer of the Salt and Light production Working in Faith. You can watch that at slmedia.org and also follow him at Jermaine Bagnall. Coming up in our second half hour, Remembering Henry Nouwen, and we meet liturgical composer Kevin Kyle. So stay tuned. Welcome to the Salt and Light Hour Part 2. I'm Deacon Pedro. Henry Nouwen is probably one of the most influential spiritual writers of our time. You might be familiar with some of his 39 books, The Wounded Healer, In the Name of Jesus, Life of the Beloved, The Way of the Heart, Return of the Prodigal Son, and Adam, God's Beloved. After 20 years of teaching, Henry Nouwen moved into the L'Arche Daybreak community in Richmond Hill, Ontario, north of Toronto, where he lived and worked with adults with intellectual disabilities. That's where Carolyn Whitney Brown met him while she was living there with her family. Henry Nouwen died in 1996, but he left one last manuscript, which Carolyn has taken and finished under the title Flying, Falling, Catching, An Unlikely Story of Finding Freedom. It tells the exhilarating true story of Henry's friendship with the Flying Rodley's Trapeze Troupe. And to tell us more, I am now joined by Carolyn Whitney Brown. Carolyn, welcome to the Salt and Light Hour. It's so good to meet you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So I have to tell you that I did my pastoral placement at Daybreak, and I always imagined what it would be like to have been there at the time when Henry Nouwen was alive, but you were there at the time when Henry Nouwen was alive. So what was that like? What was he like?
He was a delight to know. There have been a lot of writing, which is true, about his anxieties, his personal anguish. Mm-hmm. And one of the things this book really brought back to me was how much fun Henry was, how much he loved to dance at parties. He loved people. He had just a sweet, sweet energy about him. Mm. And I was thinking about Advent, you know, when we're told to be awake. And I've been thinking this week, what do I want to say about Henry? And I realized something I've never actually put words around before, is that I think Henry was one of the most awake people I've ever known.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah, his ability to pay attention to other people's realities.
Okay.
To be awake to not just his own suffering, but other people's suffering, other people's joys, his whole life trajectory. And I can say more about that leads to the Flying Rodleys.
Do you mean that he was very good at being present, listening, watching? Like, is that what you mean by being awake?
Yeah, that's part of it. And then taking what he hears and really thinking about what that means in a bigger context, this person's context.
Do you remember when you first met him? Did you know about him when you first met him?
Yeah, I had been reading his books for years. I started reading his books when I was a teenager.
Oh, wow.
So what
was it like when you first met him?
It's pretty comical. We'd written him. My husband Jeff and I were finishing PhDs in the States. And we had this sort of recovering academic, overdeveloped intellect, needing to develop our hearts, really wanting our spirits to come alive in a new way, wanting to follow Jesus much more deeply in community. Mm-hmm. So we had that in common, and we wrote to Henry, and he said, you know, come visit. And he took us out for pizza for lunch, and he was an absolutely terrible driver. it was kind of terrifying because he wanted to make eye contact while he was driving.
And right, I mean, okay.
And we went to the lunch, and they knew him at the pizza barrel there. And he was kind of following the waitress around with his empty glass, you know, and she was saying, Henry, sit down, I'll bring it to you. Mm-hmm. And he took his glasses off, and he wrapped his hands around his face. And he said, I think I get more handicapped all the time. And then he put his glasses back on and said, now tell me about you. And he remembered everything from our letters and all of our searching and our journey. And he absolutely focused. And he said to us, you're not kids trying to find yourselves. I think your lives are very directed. And that meant the world to us, because we had gone through a whole kind of journey to England, to Africa, living with different kinds of communities. And we're really listening to where Jesus called us. So focus and affirmation was huge. That was the first day we met Henry.
That's amazing. So that he was able to tune in, to zero in to the essential, I guess, of you and your husband. How did he come to know this flying trapeze troupe?
Well, it happened in 1991. He had finished his book that became The Return of the Prodigal Son. And I kind of think his spirit was open to a whole new kind of imagery. He'd spent a decade really immersed in Rembrandt's painting. And he went to the circus, a traveling circus in Germany with his father. It was a fine circus, he said, with animals and clowns and things, but it wouldn't have stayed in his mind except there was this trapeze troupe, the Flying Rodleys. And he was absolutely mesmerized by their beauty, the elegance of their performance, the trust that was needed. It did something really profound for him, so deep that he didn't really have words for it, but he knew he wanted to go back again. He went back again the next day, and he actually then took the step and took a deep breath and went and met them. And over the next 5 years, they became real friends. He rented at one point a recreation vehicle and traveled with them. He wanted to write a book about them and about their friendship. He said to other friends that it was going to be his most important book ever, that this that there was something about the way that they embodied something really profound for him about God, about trust, about community, about forgiveness of self, of others, of something about the live performance of being art in motion. He wept while watching them, and he spent 5 years trying to understand why this went so deep for him.
Okay, so this was, you already knew him when he had this encounter in 1991. So
Yeah.
did he ever speak with you about these experiences or the book that he wanted to write?
Well, yeah, I've got to be honest, we didn't take it very seriously at L'Arche. I don't think a
Really?
lot of us didn't anyway. It seemed hilarious that Henry's latest obsession was a trapeze. And we did, his 60th birthday party, we put up big banners of, trapeze troupes and things hanging in the ceiling and all. And we thought it was both really funny and rather frightening to think of him cruising around the back roads of Germany at night with a convoy of trapeze artists and caravans. But he was also, as I say, a terrible driver. So people thought this was really comical.
Now, do you know if he actually ever tried any of the trapezing
Yeah.
or the exercises that they would do?
Oh, yeah. It's what a great scene. He climbed up onto the pedestal with that they at one of their practices. They said, "Okay, Henry, come try this." And Henry, for a guy who was anxious about a lot of things, was also quite fearless about trying things and really getting on the inside of stuff. So he climbed right up, and there's actually a video of it, and really lousy handheld video, but you can see it on video. And climbs up. They hand him the trapeze. He's got a harness on with ropes. And then Rodley, the head of the Flying Rodleys, Rodley Stevens is his name, literally grabs him around the waist and throws him off the pedestal. And he swings back and forth and he drops into the net. And then you can hear everyone laughing and applauding. And he tries walking in the net and he's just lying there laughing. It's the most beautiful thing. And it also, I found it really moving because there's so much discussion of how dangerous it is to put people on pedestals, like that. This totally changes my mental image of a pedestal. A
It
pedestal
does.
is not a place to be alone. It's not a place to stay. A pedestal is you climb up with your friends. If you might get stuck on the pedestal, your friends will pick you up and throw you off.
That's fascinating. Yeah, and the pedestal as a launching pad for trust and complete surrender in a way, I suppose, if you're holding on to a trapeze.
Yeah, trusting the people around you
Trusting.
and for humor, for joy. One of the things saying about the trapeze troupe was how much they smiled at each other and enjoyed each other and the fun they were having.
So would you say, I mean, you've already given us so much and a lot of what the story is about, but in a nutshell, is there anything spiritually that we can learn from trapeze artists?
Yeah, so much, so much. Henry, through this book, he wrestles with all the different levels at which this speaks to him. And I should say about the book that I wanted Henry's words to be Henry's words. So it's actually in two typefaces, framed by me telling the story in my typeface, because there wasn't really a full manuscript. It wasn't a book. There were fragments and experiments and bits and pieces. And I tried to reconstruct something of why he loved them and why he got to where he did. So the book, yes, in two typefaces, my voice and Henry's are very distinct. The most famous thing that he also had written in his other books before his death, it was his great discovery that the flyer doesn't actually reach out and grab the catcher, that the flyer has to, as they take off with momentum, they stretch out their hands, but and the catcher comes and grabs them. And if the flyer tries to grab the catcher, it could break both their wrists. It would be really dangerous, that the flyer has to just fly and reach out and
And
trust,
trust.
and the catcher will grab them. And for him, that was a huge spiritual thing. It talks about the moment of our death. It talks about in our life. It talks about, but also about people, our relationships with each other, that we, at points, we just have to trust. And sometimes the catcher has to let the flyer fall into the net. It's the safest thing sometimes to not try to grab them, to realize this won't go, and let them fall and know they'll be safe. There's just so many layers of looking after each other in this. So the kinds of ways that that imagery spoke to him about how in motion, in the motion of our lives and the momentum of our lives, we look after each other, that we're
That
not in it alone, that we can't do it alone, that nobody flies alone.
absolutely. No, this is fascinating, Carolyn. I'm what a privilege for you to have met him and journeyed with him and been his friend and to be able to help him finish telling that story that he wanted to tell so much. So thank you for sharing it with us, not just through the book, but with us today. It's been great meeting you. Thank you.
Great, thank you. It's a joy. I love talking about Henry. Thank you.
Carolyn Whitney Brown is an artist, professor, and author. Her latest novel, co-authored with Henry Nouwen, is Flying, Falling, Catching, an unlikely story of finding freedom. It is now on paperback, and it's published by HarperCollins. Here now is Carol of the Bells from Kevin Kyle's new album, Winter Birth. That was Carol of the Bells from Kevin Kyle's new album, Winter Birth. If you're like me, you look for new Christmas music every year, especially songs that lead us to prayer and especially songs that are good for the Advent season. Now, if you're a liturgical musician, you're also likely always looking for ideas on how to use some of the old traditional Advent and Christmas hymns. This is what liturgical composer Kevin Kyle has done with his newest album, Winter Birth, which is an instrumental collection featuring six beautifully arranged, beloved Advent and Christmas hymns. And to tell us more, I am now joined by Kevin Kyle. Kevin, welcome to the Salt and Light Hour. It's good to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
So how did you end up writing sacred music?
You know, it's kind of a weird thing. Almost every music director writes church music because that's what we're doing all the time.
Right.
And of course, we always think we could do it better than somebody else. Of course. In my case, that was true. Not really. But, you know, you keep trying and you write things and you see if something's missing, maybe a responsorial psalm for a particular celebration, and you can't find one or you can't find one you like.
Right.
You give it a try. I've been very blessed because I've written a lot of stuff and I've been rejected by the finest publishers in this country. But some of it has worked and other people have enjoyed it and used it to praise God. So you can't ask for more than that.
No, you can't. No, it must be the feeling of walking into a church that's not your own parish and hear someone playing something that you composed must be, I guess, the same as tuning in and hearing your song on the radio, I guess.
It is very thrilling when you hear somebody else doing your music.
Yes, yes. Now, obviously you're a musician, you studied music. I know you play the organ and I'm always like hats off to anybody who can play the organ. So were you doing that first and you went into liturgical music in that sense? And then the composing came after is what you're saying.
Sort of.
Yeah.
The journey has been interesting. I started piano lessons when I was five.
Yeah.
And when I got to be in high school, I had entered the seminary, high school seminary.
Okay. Yes.
It was a big thing back in my day.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, but we were home on the weekends and my pastor came up to me one weekend and said, Kevin, I know you play piano, so you must be able to play organ. You start next Sunday. And so having never really touched an organ, I went from that to playing four masses every Sunday from that point on. Uh-huh. And for me, it was enjoyable, but I never thought that it would be my life's calling.
Right.
I had studied and planned on being a music teacher, but all during that time, I was working in parishes as music director or a choir director or a variety of different things. And at some point, I realized that this wasn't a job. This wasn't a career.
Mm-hmm.
This was a calling.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, I've just been doing it and doing it. And every now and then an opportunity comes up for me to write a piece of music. And, you know, I've been very blessed that other people like my music.
Yes. Yeah. When it comes to, I know, because Winter Birth is an album that just came out, but you've done similar albums in the past. The
Yes.
Glory of These 40 Days, Lenten Hymns, and even King of Love, which is kind of more for general use. But the idea seems to me to be very interesting that you're providing other liturgical musicians ideas as to how they can be more creative with some of these traditional hymns. So would you say that that's your main purpose, or is this an album that I want to just put it on my CD player and listen to it at home?
Well, most of these pieces that I've written for people in my own music ministry.
Okay.
So I may have a flute player or a violin.
Okay.
And I want to do something special with them. And so that's what I'm doing. And I don't like things that sound like somebody is just playing a song and somebody is just playing the melody along mm-hmm. with them. Mm-hmm. I find that very boring.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to write interesting harmonies and
right.
twists and turns. And that makes, for me, the music more enjoyable. Of course, it drives the soloist crazy, but that's okay.
No, but it makes it more more pleasant for the listener. So Is your hope then that a liturgical musician can be inspired to do, to maybe even write their own? Or I mean, I know the sheet music exists, so if I have a flute player in my parish, I could say, hey, this song, hey, here's a flute part for O Come Emmanuel or whatever. I mean, I guess that that's an option that everybody has when they listen to your music.
Well, these pieces were written specifically to be played in parishes as a prelude before Mass
Okay.
begins, or maybe at the offertory, different things like that. But I would be delighted if my writing inspired somebody else to do their own. Because ultimately, you want to pass on. You want people to be inspired and perhaps given some tools that they can use to create music of their own.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you find that there's something specifically challenging about the Advent, maybe even Lent, but Advent Christmas season when it comes to doing music or music in church?
Advent's not too bad. The problem with Christmas is, of course, there's a limited repertoire and we all know the songs.
Yeah.
And so, when I was writing the Christmas side of this particular collection, I tried to come at it kind of sideways so that it's not going to sound like everybody else's Angels We Have Heard on High or O Come, O Come Emmanuel. It will have a unique sound that I like to think is my own.
Do you have any advice then for that liturgical musician that's listening right now, thinking, oh, I don't know what to do. I'm so tired of O come, Emmanuel, and O come, divine Messiah. What's your advice for them?
Don't be afraid to try and write your own arrangements and be bold. Don't think that something you're writing just sounds too weird or too different from other arrangements. There's no reason why you can't try. Also, the other thing I always tell people is be careful because when you write music, you fall in love with that piece of music like you would for a child. And not everybody's going to love your child like you love your child. So you have to be able at times to take criticism and to accept somebody else's opinion and maybe revisit that piece of music with the suggestions that you might have gotten from people.
Yeah, that's good advice. Sometimes the one who doesn't like your child is the pastor. I'm also the idea of using instrumental music in liturgy to me is interesting as well. And you mentioned a few places, a prelude. I mean, really, that's really before Mass even starts. But I'm thinking of a second communion or a reflection hymn. Are there places where you think instrumental music works well and it's appropriate for liturgy?
Oh, absolutely. As I mentioned, the prelude before the Mass begins, so you can kind of create an atmosphere for everybody to get into the worship experience. I like to do things at the preparation of the gifts instead of singing a song sometimes. That's a very quiet time, and people, if you're not singing a song, can actually kind of enter into what's going on the altar, the gifts, and all that preparation. And also staying in the mood, especially, let's say you have an instrumental that ties into the homily that people just heard. Maybe Father mentioned this particular hymn or this idea, and then you have an instrumental that grabs onto that in a way that people recognize. And now they can start thinking more and more about the homily instead of like, homily's done, I'm out of here.
Yeah, exactly.
And definitely after communion, the church says that we really should have time after communion to meditate, not medicate, to meditate. And it's nice sometimes to have silence, but at other times it's nice to have a piece of music that can also draw you into the prayer experience.
Yeah. Well, that's really good advice, Kevin. Thank you for sharing that. And I've really enjoyed speaking with you. You've given me something to think about here as I go. I'm not doing liturgical music anymore because now I'm the deacon. I have a different function, but I did it for many, many years, and I know the challenges, the struggles, and the many blessings that come with it. So thank you for inspiring us today.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
You can learn more about Kevin Kyle and purchase his music at Oregon Catholic Press, OCP.org. And if you missed any part of this interview, head on over to our website, slmedia.org/podcast. All our programs are archived there. Here now is Angels We Have Heard on High from Kevin Kyle's new album, Winter Birth. Listening to Angels We Have Heard on High from Kevin Kyle's new album, Winter Birth. And that will take us to the end of the program today. Listen to the full program on our website, slmedia.org, or subscribe to the Salt and Light Hour Catholic podcast anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also now listen to the Salt and Light Hour on the new Salt and Light Plus app, where you can also watch Salt and Light TV and all our videos and documentaries. It's an easy download from your favorite app store. This week, let's continue to pray for peace in Ukraine and peace in the Holy Land. We also pray for Burkina Faso and the people in Burkina Faso. They need peace too. We pray for all those who need to let go, even when they're afraid of falling. And I pray that you have a blessed end of Advent and a most blessed and holy Christmas season. I'm Deacon Pedro, and this has been the Salt and Light Hour.